impeach Dilma Rousseff because we can't tolerate corruption. Speaking to somebody with millions of dollars in bribes in Swiss bank accounts. And so people have started to realize internationally, but also here in Brazil, that although this impeachment process has been sold, has been pitched as a way of punishing corruption, its real goal, beyond empowering neoliberals and Goldman Sachs and foreign hedge funds, the real goal is to protect corruption.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept speaking last week in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking tonight at the First Parish Church Meeting House in Cambridge at 6:30. Then Wednesday night in Montclair, New Jersey at Congregation Shomer Emuna. On Thursday night at Barnes & Noble Union Square in New York. And Friday I'll be in Washington, D.C. at Plymouth Congregational Church. Then for the weekend, it's on Saturday to Portland and Bangor, Maine. Sunday to Bar Harbor, Maine. And Democracy Now! Has job openings, video news production fellowship, and our internship program. Check out democracynow.org. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan and our crew. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for the KBOO Tuesday Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is the proud co-sponsor of the World Beat PDX monthly series featuring Wamba on Thursday, May 12th at the Analog Cafe in Portland. Wamba plays percussive jazz and funk with a strong World Beat influence and will be playing two sets that evening. Again, that's Wamba on Thursday, May 12th at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pan-African Film Series. This month, May 18th at 6 p.m., will be A Message from Women in Gambia at the Smith Student Union at Portland State University. A Message from the Women of Gambia will feature young women organizers from the All African Women's Revolutionary Union and the All African People's Revolutionary Party speaking about organizing for Pan-Africanism in Gambia and throughout Africa. Again, that's a message from the Women of Gambia, a part of the Pan-African Film Festival, Wednesday, May 18th at 6 p.m. at the Smith Student Union Room 333 at PSU, 1826 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland State University students walk out on classes today to protest arming of Campus Police Bureau. We have a student live in Studio 2.
A decision this week from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers marks the first time a coal export facility has been rejected based on its negative impact on the treaty rights of a tribal nation.
And Donald Trump has offered to exempt London's newly elected Muslim mayor Sadiq Khan from a ban on Muslims entering America. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 10th, 2016. I'm Jenny Okuyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. Intel is in the process of downsizing its workforce by 11% nationwide. Last month, the company laid off almost 800 employees at its Aloha and Hillsboro campuses. Some workers were shocked to receive the pink slips, while others saw it coming. Hundreds more Oregon Intel employees have been offered buyouts and early retirement packages to leave their jobs over the next year. On Monday, Intel threatened further layoffs if an insufficient number of employees failed to accept the offered buyouts.
A former police officer in the town of Clatskanie, Oregon, has filed suit against a city he served for 8 years after being fired in an alleged retaliation for blowing the whistle on his chief. last summer, Zach Gibson and another officer in the four-person police force filed an official complaint against Police Chief Marvin Hoover for an incident remarks made regarding African Americans and a female employee of the district office. Officer Gibson filed the complaint against Chief Hoover despite being warned by another officer that staff with the city of Clatskanie would, quote, make life a living hell for them in response. After submitting the complaint against Chief Hoover, Officer Gibson was placed on administrative leave two separate times. He was investigated by the city and private investigators on the grounds that he made sexually inappropriate comments in the workplace. After finding no evidence of wrongdoing, Gibson was fired by City Manager Greg Hinkleman for violating local policy, quote, relating to untruthfulness. No further detail of Gibson's alleged infractions have been made available. In the lawsuit documents, Gibson claims that his firing was a direct result of his whistleblowing that exposed the police chief's inappropriate workplace behavior, and that city leaders denied him the right to know the specific allegations against him.
This Thursday at 6 p.m., there will be a hearing at Portland City Hall where the residents of Oakleaf Mobile Home Park in the Cully neighborhood will be asking the city for funding to help them buy the park back from the owner. Currently, 30 families are set to lose their housing to make way for high-end housing. These residents will be priced out of Portland, and some of them will face homelessness. Activists say they are currently organizing and mobilizing funds, but they still need help from the city. The hearing is at Portland City Hall this Thursday, May 12th, at 6 p.m.
If your heart broke just a little when the Rose Garden Arena became the Moda Center, you may not want to hear this next story. In a desperate bid for funds, Yosemite National Park is wooing corporate donors and reconsidering its resistance to corporate names on buildings within the park. It's allowing an auditorium inside the park to be named after Coca-Cola. The National Park System has historically relied on philanthropic donations to fund the 411 parks, monuments, and conservation areas under the control of the National Park Service, but Director Jonathan Jarvis now wants to open the system to a higher level of corporate donations. Jarvis proposed the expanded rules for donations in March in a 33-page order that's set to take effect by the end of the year. According to the proposed policy, naming rights will be given for everything from bricks and paving stones to recreation and youth programs. Donors may be even allowed to design and build park buildings, maybe even operating them in the long run. Park officials say the policy shift was prompted by an $11 billion backlog of maintenance projects, coupled with funding from Congress that has not kept pace with the rising costs.
The U.S. Department of Justice has filed for a federal civil rights lawsuit against the state of North Carolina over the discriminatory bathroom bill, which forces transgendered people to use bathrooms that don't match their gender identity. We go to Nell Abrams with Free Speech Radio News for the story.
Some of you have lived freely for decades, and others of you are still wondering how you can possibly live the lives that you were born to live, to lead. But no matter how isolated, no matter how afraid, and no matter how alone you may feel today, know this, that the Department of Justice, and indeed the entire Obama administration, want you to know that we see you, we stand with you, and we will do everything we can to protect you going forward. And please know that history is on your side.
That's Attorney General Loretta Lynch speaking directly to transgender Americans as she announced a federal civil rights lawsuit against the state of North Carolina, its governor, the State Department of Public Safety, and the University of North Carolina. The legal action concerns state law HB 2, a measure that prohibits transgender individuals from using public restrooms that correspond to their gender identity. The bill states specifically the bathrooms designed to accommodate more than one person must be single-sex facilities, and that sex is defined as the physical condition of being male or female, which is stated on a person's birth certificate. Attorney General Lynch says this bill goes far beyond determining who can use which restroom.
This is about the dignity and the respect that we accord our fellow citizens and the laws that we as a people and as a country have enacted to protect them, indeed to protect all of us. And it's about the founding ideals that have led this country, haltingly but inexorably, in the direction of fairness, inclusion, and equality for all Americans.
The DOJ claims fall under two sections of the Civil Rights Act and the later Violence Against Women Act. The suit asks the court to declare the law impermissibly discriminatory and bar its enforcement. Further, Lynch said the DOJ reserves the right to withhold federal funding to the state's public safety department and the university as the case moves forward. The announcement came just hours after Governor Pat McCrory announced his own legal action against the DOJ. The legal maneuvers follow three letters the DOJ sent to North Carolina officials, putting them on notice that the law violates the Federal Civil Rights Act, specifically Title VII, which protects employees from workplace discrimination on the basis of sex. Further, the Justice Department wrote that federal courts have already applied Title VII protection for transgender individuals against discrimination based on sex, including gender identity. North Carolina, however, disputes that legal analysis. In a public announcement earlier Monday, Governor McCrory accused the Justice Department of trying to rewrite the law, adding that he expects private sector groups and even other states to join his case, asking the federal courts to clarify the law.
Ultimately, I think it's time for the U.S. Congress to bring clarity to our national anti-discrimination provisions under Title VII and Title IX. Now, right now, the Obama administration is bypassing Congress by attempting to rewrite the law and set basic restroom policies, locker room policies, and even shower policies for public and private employers across the country, not just North Carolina.
North Carolina lawmakers introduced, passed, signed, and enacted HB 2 over the course of a single day in March. Public response was swift. Human rights advocates and LGBT activists and their supporters quickly launched protests. Artists and musicians canceled major performance dates in the state. More than a dozen conventions were immediately lost in the Charlotte area alone. And at least two big businesses, PayPal and Deutsche Bank, put plans to expand in the state on hold. HB 2 supporters say the bill is not aimed at discriminating against transgender individuals, but rather to protect girls from sexual predators disguising themselves as females to gain entry to public restrooms. Opponents reject this claim, noting there are no such incidents on record. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
What causes addictions and how can sufferers be cured? Tomorrow night, Science on Tap at the Keegan's Theater in Vancouver takes up this fascinating topic with memory and the neuroscience of addiction. Here to speak about this is Amanda Thompson of VIA Production. Thanks for being with us, Amanda.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So first of all, what is Science on Tap?
Science on Tap is a science lecture with beer. We feel that we want to appeal to as many people in the general public as we can. And we think that including beer or other adult beverages might appeal to people who might not otherwise come to a science lecture. And I feel it's really important to educate adults about science, possibly even more than appealing to kids, because adults vote and make decisions based on information. And if they can have better scientific information, they'll make better decisions.
With beer.
Yes.
So how do you decide what you're going to create an event on at Science on Tap?
I draw from a number of the local universities and organizations to find my speakers. We have a partnership with Washington State University Vancouver for our event in Vancouver. We also have an event in Portland. And we are, for example, the speaker who is speaking tomorrow night, Dr. Barbara Sorg, is a professor of neuroscience at WSU Vancouver. And we have featured a number of their faculty at several of our events. I've also worked with a number of people from PSU or OHSU and lots of other organizations and universities. And I get recommendations from previous speakers. They recommend their colleagues. I find people who are in the audience make suggestions. I find a lot of people just kind of word of mouth. And generally, fortunately, because we talk about science, we can talk about pretty much anything related to science. So if as long as the person is an engaging speaker, we'll bring them and talk about anything.
Well, speaking of who comes in to hear your lectures, so what kind of audience come to your science events and who specifically are you trying to reach?
Well, as I mentioned before, we're trying to reach people in the general public. Generally, the people who are there are smart and curious and may or may not have a background in science. Some of them do and maybe don't have a background in the specific area we're discussing. And other people are not related to science at all. The last science class they took was in high school. But we try to appeal to as wide of a spectrum of the general public as we can. The topics are not super jargon heavy, or you know, there's not a lot of math equations or things like that. They're fun and accessible.
All right, let's talk about your event that you're having tomorrow night.
Mm-hmm.
You have an expert coming in named Dr. Barbara Sorg, mm-hmm. a neuroscientist professor at WSU. Can you talk a little bit about her work?
Well, let me say that I'm not a neuroscientist, so I may get some of the information about the addiction a little bit off. But if you come tomorrow night, you'll be able to get the information directly from her. But her work deals with correlating memories and addiction. So they work with rats to find out how memory and addiction are connected. And for example, if somebody has a memory of an addictive behavior and they go to a place where that memory is very strong and they have a lot of emotions around that, even if they are in recovery, they might relapse because of the chemicals in their brains are saying, oh, you have this memory and you should use again. And so Dr. Sorg's lab is studying how to interrupt those memory transmissions and potentially keep people from relapsing.
And is this what Dr. Sorg is going to be speaking about tomorrow night, the work that she's been doing at her lab?
Yes, she will be talking a little bit about addiction in general and how it works in the brain and the neurotransmitters that are involved in addiction and the different parts of the brain that are related. And she'll also be talking specifically about her work with cocaine and rats and how that may be relevant to future human subjects.
Now, I know you're not an expert in neuroscience, but just what is the kind of basic definition of addiction?
Well, I spoke with Dr. Sorg on the way over here, so I could make sure to get an accurate answer to this question. And she was saying that the addiction is a chronic behavior, a chronic negative behavior that the person continues to do despite all negative consequences. So despite the fact that you might lose your home or your family or have other negative outcomes, you still continue to do that. You're unable to stop.
So can you explain how Dr. Sorg's work offers ideas about breaking away from addictions?
Well, if they can figure out, if they can identify how the addictive memories are created, they're from what I understand, they are looking at ways to break down possibly an actual neurochemical intervention of making those memories not be as powerful as they were, and therefore potentially helping keep the rats, in this case, from relapsing. So there's lots of different ways to treat addiction, and no one way is going to work for everybody. But if they can come up with an actual chemical way of treating it, that I believe that's what they're looking for.
So why don't you circle back to the idea of memories feeding into relapse?
Yeah, well, as I was...
Explain that.
as I was trying to explain before, if you are... any experience you have creates a memory, and when you remember those things, you have certain feelings about that, and those feelings release different neurotransmitters like dopamine or epinephrine or those kinds of things you may have heard of. And when an addict is in a location that they have used before, perhaps those chemicals are being stimulated more than they might be in other locations, and so they get that same feeling again. They decide that they want to use because they have this feeling like, oh, I feel compelled to use. And even if they've been in recovery and been very successful at not using, being in those locations or being around those people and having those memories and those chemical feelings in your brain might inspire you to use again.
Also sounds like kind of breaking that bond of the associative memory.
Exactly.
I see. So, Amanda, will Dr. Sorg also be talking about cannabis? I know that some people argue that cannabis is not addictive, yet we have seen reports that daily use of cannabis can change how the user's brainwave patterns work.
When I spoke to Dr. Sorg earlier today, she was saying that it's not really clear because since cannabis is a Schedule I drug, still there's not a lot of research allowed on it. So there's no good answer to that. And also, some people may use cannabis and it is potentially more addictive for them, and other people may use a similar amount and it's not addictive, and it's not clear why or how that works. So I believe the jury is still out on the addictive qualities of cannabis at this point until there's more research that's able to be done.
So we're almost running out of time here. How can listeners support Science on Tap? Actually, how can they find out more information about you guys?
Well, you can find us on Facebook or on Meetup at Science on Tap OR, or Oregon and Washington, Science on Tap ORWA. There are other Science on Tap events happening around the country. We're not necessarily affiliated with them, but they are having science lectures in bars. So we appreciate and encourage that. But you can find us on Facebook. Or you can check us out. We have a podcast called A Scientist Walks Into a Bar. And that podcast features several of our past lectures from a number of our past events. And you can find that on iTunes or in any of your podcast listening apps.
Well, thank you very much, Amanda, for coming in. And that was Amanda Thomas from Science on Tap at Vancouver's Kiggins Theater. The event is tomorrow night and is Memory and the Neuroscience of Addiction. At the Kiggins Theater, it's at 1011 Main Street in Vancouver, Washington. So if you're here in Portland, hop on over and you can hear that lecture going over there. And you can find out more about Science on Tap at www.viaproductions.org. One more time. So it's a little messy there. www.viaproductions.org. Thank you very much, Amanda.
Thank you.
It's just about 5:21, which means it's time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Coal mining is a filthy business. Literally, miners not only get covered in the soot of their trade, but also suffer the suffocating death called black lung. The industry explodes mountaintops, contaminates mountain streams and drinking water, and causes both acid rain and climate change. Then there are the murders. Oh, they're not called murders, but intentionally sending workers 1,000 feet underground into poorly ventilated tunnels filled with explosive methane gas and coal dust without providing proven safety equipment amounts to signing a murder contract with the Lord of the Underground. That's what Don Blankenship did as CEO of Massey Energy. Recklessly pushing profits over safety, he oversaw the corporate murder of 29 West Virginia miners and the predictable horror of an enormously violent detonation deep inside Massey's upper Big Branch mine in 2010. Now, at long last, Boss Blankenship has been convicted and sentenced in federal court. Not for murder, though. Under our nation's feeble Mine Safety Act, killing 29 miners is a misdemeanor, and the punishment handed down to this multimillionaire corporate crime boss was merely 1 year in jail and a $250,000 fine. Such soft-on-crime leniency is not the fault of the jury or judge. They did the most with what the law allows for punishing industrial criminals. In fact, Blankenship is the first mining CEO ever convicted of conspiring to violate safety protections for miners. Rather, our corrupt corporate-serving Congress critters are to blame. Key lawmakers have taken millions of dollars in campaign donations from barons like Blankenship in exchange for reducing corporate murder to a misdemeanor. This is Jim Hightower saying, the filthiest thing about big coal is its immoral use of filthy political money to let its bosses literally get away with murder.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Geraldine Roman became the first transgender politician in the Philippines to hold office this week. She comes from a line of politicians and replacing the seat previously occupied by her mother. She's dedicated to continuing the fight for LGBT rights within the predominantly Catholic country.
Donald Trump has graciously offered to exempt London's newly elected Muslim mayor, Sadiq Khan, from a ban on Muslims entering America. Trump had previously called for a, quote, total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States, end quote, in the wake of last year's terror attacks in Paris. Khan responded this morning as follows.
I think Donald Trump has ignorant views about Islam. It's not just about me. I don't want to be the exception to be allowed to go to America.
According to a new report from the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University, anti-Muslim hate crimes increased in 2015.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for a special encore airing of Preference at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high of 84 degrees. Today in history, in 1872, Victoria Claflin Woodhull became the first female candidate for President of the United States. Together with her sister, Tennessee Claflin, Victoria started Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly, a radical journal that published the first English translation of Karl Marx's The Communist Manifesto. The quote of the day is from Victoria Woodhull, who said, "Is it fair to treat a woman worse than a man and then revile her because she is a woman?"
Hundreds of Portland State University students walked out of class today protesting the arming of campus security. Their protest included handing a letter to the PSU administration as well as a die-in, where protesting students blocked traffic by lying in the street in front of the PSU administrative building. Here to talk about the walkout is Scout Zabel and Sam Erbs, organizers with SUSU, also known as the Portland State University Student Union. Thanks for coming in, Scout, Sam.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So what were the reasons behind the organized walkout today?
Well, we've had issues with the administration for years where when they first introduced the idea of an armed campus security, we were present at every board meeting to protest this. And over and over again, we weren't listened to. They purposely held meetings like during finals week at like inopportune times. The meetings were never advertised. It was like really difficult to engage with the administration. So not only are we protesting like the arming of campus security, when our campus security already is known for like abusing houseless people and mentally ill people, but also just the way that our school's administration is like really bureaucratic and really hierarchical and much more focused on profit than the actual input of students.
Yeah, I think that's like the important thing is like on the one hand, obviously we are opposed to the arming of the campus police, but we're also, it's also like kind of a wider issue. It's that like at every turn the administration marginalizes, ignores, demonizes and makes fun of us. I mean, when you go to one of these open comment things where they like, oh, we love students to come and talk, and then you're giving your open comment, which, you know, you've put time to write a speech in because you care about the issue, and they're all just sort of, you know, down texting, like below the table, like not even, won't even make eye contact with you. I mean, they don't care. They're just there to do their thing and then do whatever they want.
And are you guys talking about the board meetings specifically?
Yeah, we're the Board of Trustees, the unelected representatives who make the decisions for our school.
Mm-hmm. So you're both clearly pretty involved in this as it exists at PSU, but are you aware of this being an issue on other campuses in Oregon or in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, when our board of trustees was implemented at our school like 2 years ago, they also did it at other public universities in Oregon and really like across the country. And for the most part, in every school, these are people that are have like a lot of corporate affiliation and don't really have ties to education and are kind of brought on for the purposes of like corporatizing universities more than they actually care about education.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this struggle is being fought, both the campus cops issue and the lack of administrative, like giving a crap slash democratic control of the university is being fought. I mean, you see that at the occupations and chancellor's offices across the country. You see it at, a while ago, I don't remember which school it was, where the football team refused, said we're not playing another game until these demands are met. Like, students are seeing that the only method of sort of getting the education that they were promised, that we were all sold on, is to basically fight for it. Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the Portland State University Student Union, what you're engaged in having to do with these sit-ins and these direct action events, but also beyond?
We do a lot of educational stuff also. Our main campaign right now is Disarm PSU, but we're also really involved in the Fight for 15 for campus workers and breaking ties with Aramark. And what's our fourth one?
Oh, and the administrator is basically taking a pay cut
yeah.
in order to enable us to have basically an improved education. You know, so we're having tuition increases and we're having this and that. And meanwhile, you know, they're spending all this money on remodeling buildings that no one uses and giving pay raises to administrators and et cetera.
Yeah. So all of the issues are kind of intimately connected. And our main focus right now is Disarm. But we're also we have members that are especially involved in like the fight for tuition and all that.
So our listeners understand the scope of this issue. When did the campus security at PSU get armed?
Last summer.
July 1st.
Yeah.
And what are the reasons that the administration has given for needing an armed campus security force?
They've said that it will stop a school shooter from coming on campus, despite the fact that the more we have militarized campuses, school shooting has not decreased at all. They've said that it will stop sexual assault on campus or decrease sexual assault on campus. And they've also said that it will protect students from houseless and mentally ill people on campus, despite the fact that we have houseless and mentally ill students on campus.
And their own statistics like just don't really show that as being a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the second one is the most absurd, just to say it. It basically, it paints like, you know, sexual assault as an issue of like, you know, men in masks jumping out of bushes and like, oh, well, we're just going to shoot them. I mean, like, anyone who knows anything knows that that's like an infinitesimally small part of this issue. And mm-hmm. so for them to say that arming the campus cops is going to affect that is just like really disrespectful to people who experience like sexual violence.
Yeah. And campus security was also already really poor at dealing with issues of sexual assault, and adding guns to the equation isn't going to improve. They're already like very poor training. Yeah.
So today your group delivered a letter to the PSU administration. What was in that letter, and has the administration responded yet?
Well, actually, I think important note is they locked the door and wouldn't let us in.
Mm-hmm.
So the Market Center building, which is the main administrative building for the administration, anytime they know that there's any student action on campus, they lock it with a cop who lets someone in and out every time they need to go in. Yeah, they have no interest. I mean, they don't care about us. Like, that's the thing, is it's not like, they will use words like dialogue and you know, democratic engagement. And they're just like empty words, because when we actually do attempt to do those things, they lock the door, they text under the table, they just ignore us and marginalize us.
Mm-hmm.
But a scout can speak more to what was in the letter.
Yeah, the letter was kind of like a call-out letter. It was explaining the situation. We've been really labeled as being like a small group of vocal students, and that the vast majority of students don't care about this issue or like agree with the administration on this issue. So we kind of just were like, well, here's not a small group of students, here's a large group of students who care about this. And kind of just overviewing how frustrated we were with the complete lack of response to the administration to our concerns, and kind of commenting on how Vim Vavelle consistently has proven that he doesn't care about student voice, and that he doesn't care about students who are like dealing with food insecurity and houselessness while he receives a $600,000 salary and
a mansion and a car and a maid service
and a cell phone service
all paid for with my tuition dollars. Meanwhile, like they said, you know, so we have a, this is like sad, but we have a food pantry on campus because so many kids are suffering from, you know, food insecurity. And up until recently, it was in like this tiny little storage room that was way too small for the amount of students that were wanting to use it. They just moved them to a bigger room, which is bigger, but in the basement, way out of the way. You know, meanwhile, the original location was right next to a conference room, which is almost never used and could have totally been perfect for it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just that Vivelle doesn't care about students at all in the least, and he's made that clear like every step along the way for the entire time I've engaged with PSU in any way.
Mm-hmm. So shifting gears just a little bit, so since students of color and students in the LGBTQ community are statistically more likely to be negatively affected by the arming of campus security, what has the PSU administration done, if anything, to assure students of color that they will be safe?
Well, they haven't really addressed the safety of students of color and LGBTQ students with regards to campus security, other than the idea that campus security is going to make everyone safer. But Vimavelle has talked a lot about diversity and how much he loves the diversity at PSU. Even we have him quoted as saying he wants to capitalize on the diversity at PSU. And that's kind of
phrasing.
Yeah. I think that's kind of sums up his position.
Diversity to him is a selling point, not like a success of, you know, social equality. I think that the only thing that they've done is like really weird and hollow, like sort of paltry efforts. Like a while ago, they had a student of color speak out, which was an event organized by the school that was basically, you know, come express your frustration of living under this, you know, capitalist, racist society, white supremacist society we live in. And he came, which was like, you know, the gall of it. And then he just sort of sat there and looked bored the whole time. And then, if I remember correctly, left early, but mm-hmm. that might not be correct. And then nothing came of it. You know, like it was student after student coming on stage and like, the arming of campus cops makes me feel uncomfortable. This school is full of racial, both micro and macro aggression. And he just sat there, you know, stone faced, and then left early. And we continue the fight of he doesn't care.
Yeah, we've had like incidents of like white student unions being created at our school and flyers being plastered at our school that say like Islamophobic and racist things. And we put out publicly, like the student union publicly talks about these things and urges like the administration to even acknowledge that it's happening. And there's no response whatsoever. And then maybe a couple months later, they'll have an info session on Islamophobia that lasts an hour. And Vim is there for the first 10 minutes and leaves. And that's like a solution to this.
It's like, we solved Islamophobia on campus.
Hmm. Well, there's clearly a lot more conversation here to be had. I wish we had more time, but we're completely out of time. I'm sorry. But lastly, just really quickly, if people want to, for example, read the letter that was delivered today or follow you on social media, sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot if it hasn't been posted yet, but where can people find you?
Oh, yeah. Our Facebook page is really great for all of our information. It should be PSU Student Union on the internet. Check it out.
I found you on by searching hashtag disarm PSU.
Oh, yeah. Also, you can find us via our hashtag, too. And if you were there today, please post things with that hashtag.
Yeah, and also just a little tiny plug. If you are a student who's listening and you're interested in getting involved, or if you're just a community member who's interested in supporting us, you know, either reach out to the Facebook page, or if you're a student, we have weekly meetings Monday in the basement of Smith on campus. If people know, right in front of the Green Roots Cafe. If not, just go to the basement and you'll see a big group of people. And that's the number one way to get involved with the student struggle on campus.
Oh, yeah. So once again, that's the hashtag disarm PSU, DISARMPSU. Thank you, Sam and Scout.
Cool. Yeah,
appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Thank you for having us.
So that was Scout Zabel and Sam Erb, and organizers with the Portland State University Student Union. You can learn more about their efforts at www.psusu.com. You can also find them on Facebook.
And now it's time for a community rights commentary from Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. This past December and January, I did a six-part commentary series on what I call the Cancer Industrial Complex. It's all archived at paulcienfuegos.com. Today, I'm going to return to this critical topic as the Relay for Life annual event is happening in less than a week all over the U.S., sponsored by the American Cancer Society, which in my opinion is the largest phony nonprofit organization on the planet. I think it would be more accurate to describe the American Cancer Society as an extremely effective front group for the cancer industry. But they're not alone. Other phony cancer organizations include the Komen Foundation, the Cancer Research Foundation, and many others. Breast Cancer Action is a wonderful organization that has been a leading truth-teller in this effort for years. Recently, they've been running a campaign that they call Think Before You Pink. Here are some excerpts from their action alert titled Four Questions to Ask Before You Walk for Breast Cancer. Each year, hundreds of thousands of people come together to participate in breast cancer walks and runs in cities across the U.S. If you want to be sure your time and money are truly making a difference, here are some easy questions to ask before participating in or donating to breast cancer walks. Question number one, how much money raised from the walk will go to breast cancer programs? Organizations promote their cancer walks by suggesting that the money raised by walk participants goes straight to supporting breast cancer programs. But the reality is a big chunk of the money raised is often unaccounted for. For example, the Avon 39 Walk to End Breast Cancer requires participants to raise $1,800 and states on its website that this money is given to local, regional, and national breast cancer organizations. Yet of the $34 million raised from their events in 2015, about 47% of the money, about $16 million, is not publicly accounted for. Question number two, what breast cancer programs will the walk fund? Organizations promote their walks by suggesting that the money raised by walk participants goes to breast cancer programs that save women's lives. But the reality is, organizations that put on walks sometimes mislead participants by using the money raised to fund ineffective efforts like empty awareness or early detection programs, which have not reduced breast cancer death rates. Meanwhile, research programs that remain severely underfunded include those looking into the environmental links to breast cancer that could prevent women from getting breast cancer in the first place, and those that look into metastatic breast cancer so fewer women die of the disease. Question number three, do the walk's sponsors increase women's risk of breast cancer? Organizations promote their corporate sponsors as genuinely caring about women with breast cancer. But the reality is some corporations and organizations involved in breast cancer walks put their own profit before women's health by pinkwashing. Pinkwashing is a term we coined in 2002 to describe a company or organization that claims to care about breast cancer, but at the same time makes or promotes products linked to the disease. For example, each year the Avon Foundation puts on multi-day breast cancer walks in cities nationwide. But Avon Products, the multi-billion dollar cosmetics corporation behind the foundation, uses chemicals in its makeup that are linked to an increased risk of breast cancer, such as methylparaben. Organizations promote their walks by suggesting that overcoming a breast cancer diagnosis is as simple as fighting hard, getting an annual mammogram, and thinking positively. But no amount of individual willpower, screening, or positive thinking can protect women from developing metastatic breast cancer, an incurable diagnosis that kills 40,000 women each year. There are many meaningful ways to take an active role in addressing and ending the breast cancer epidemic. If you can't answer the above questions to your satisfaction, you may want to consider these alternative ways to take action. One, contact organizations and corporations that put on breast cancer walks to get answers to the questions above, and then demand changes that you want to see. Two, volunteer for or give directly to a breast cancer organization that does not take money from pinkwashing companies that profit from the disease at the expense of our health. Three, learn more and educate others about the history and politics of the breast cancer movement by hosting a film screening of the documentary Pink Ribbons, Inc., Breast Cancer and the Politics of Philanthropy. Four, share your story to help others think critically about these fundraising events. I've been reading excerpts from an action alert titled Think Before You Pink published by Breast Cancer Action, a group that is quite critical of the established cancer organizations that raise enormous amounts of money every year, much of it from the same corporations that cause the cancer they claim to be fighting. The original unedited version of this document can be accessed by visiting the text version of this commentary at paulcienfuegos.com. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the Cable Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Grace Ann Smith, Dominic Anaya, Tony Longshanks, and Jenna Yokoyama. The producer is Kanan Schlesinger. Special thanks to Tanya Gomez-Daza and Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Philomath on K282BH at 104.3 FM, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on K220HR. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7 a.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Roland welcomes a delegation of activist Lumads, indigenous people from the island of Mindanao in the Philippines who are on a U.S. tour to talk about their situation and struggles. At 9 on Political Perspectives, host Per Fangarang interviews journalist and author Jeremy Scahill about his new book, The Assassination Complex, Inside the Government's Secret Drone Warfare Program. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 11 on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen discusses the single most important thing you can do as a gardener: make and use compost. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our spring membership drive. You helped us get very close to our goal, so thank you very, very much. Have a good night, Kanan.
Night, Jenna.